It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up later in the program, we'll hear about a new set of school standards known as Common Core that's getting some pushback from a variety of groups.
But first, we take a look at what's happening in the soda industry. Since the launch of Coke and Pepsi in the late 1880s, soda's pretty much been a staple of the American diet.
But those times are changing, and Americans aren't reaching as often for those sugary drinks and their diet counterparts. So how is the soda industry trying to win consumers back? We're joined now by Candace Choi. She covers the food and beverage industry for the Associated Press.
Candace, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you get the sense that the soda industry isn't what it used to be. There's such a huge push right now for people to give up soda for their health, usually often for losing weight. Can you give us a sense of where soda sales are right now?
Well, soda sales have been gradually declining, actually, in terms of per capita sales, have been declining for the past 15 years now. So people have been cutting back on soda for some time. I think what's new is that, or newer, is that diet soda sales are falling as well, and they're actually falling at a faster rate than regular soda.
Is it a cultural thing that's happening that we're drinking less soda, or can you pin it on Dr. Oz or somebody in particular?
Well, I think there's a lot of factors at play. I mean, the biggest one that people talk about is just, you know, the worry about weight gain because of the high fructose corn syrup in soda. But I think it's bigger than that. There's just so many more options in the beverage aisle now. There's just bottled teas, flavored waters, you know, seltzer waters. And I think soda, just more broadly, whether you're talking about diet or regular, you know, has this bad health image. It doesn't have any, you know, nutritional benefits. And there are all these other options that kind of promise some sort of functionality or benefit now.
Well, diet soda used to be a pretty hot thing. I can remember when everybody was drinking Tab, when I guess I would have been a kid when that was happening.
They're actually trying to bring back Tab.
Are they? But now we're worried about artificial sweeteners, right? And that's something that hasn't had, all of the research is not in yet on that. But how is that affecting the diet soda industry?
Well, Coke and Pepsi, executives there think that, you know, that is the reason why diet soda sales are falling, is that there's these concerns about artificial sweeteners. And, you know, even though the FDA says it's safe to use in foods and drinks, and it's used in a lot of other foods and drinks, I mean, there's the sense that the evidence out there is inconclusive, you know, if people are drinking it over a lifetime. And also, just more broadly, I think people don't like the idea of artificial anything anymore. Like, there's just a movement toward organic and natural ingredients. So I think that is part of the reason diet soda sales are suffering as well.
Do you have a sense of who is still drinking soda right now?
You know, I think it's probably people, it goes across a wide range, but I think it's just a lot of people are drinking less of it because the household penetration is still very high. I mean, it's in virtually all homes in terms of, you know, people at some point, you know, drink soda, you know, in any given week or month. I think it's just that people have cut back enormously, again, because of health reasons or because there are just so many more options now.
Now, at the same time, there's this whole new selection of, you know, quote-unquote healthier sodas.
Right.
There's, I guess, Pepsi Next and Dr. Pepper 10. These are low-calorie sodas. Are they going to change anything, or is this just a sign that the industry is desperate?
Well, the jury's still out. I mean, Pepsi Next and Dr. Pepper 10 are both still relatively new. Pepsi Next is just a year old. But, I mean, it's not the first time that these companies have tried, like, mid-calorie sodas. Coke had something called C2, and Pepsi had something called Pepsi Edge. And, you know, they were on the market for a couple of years, and they disappeared. Because the thinking is, you know, if somebody wants to cut back in calories, why wouldn't they just go for a diet that has zero calories? So what companies are trying to do now, the next, you know, big thing is something that has no calories yet is natural at the same time. So the big thing that everyone's talking about is Stevia or Truvia is the brand name. And Coke has actually introduced a Coke with Stevia in Argentina. And it's seen as sort of like a test, you know, before, because it's easier to gauge the response in a smaller market.
So that might win back the people who are worried about things being natural. So,
right, exactly.
The thing about stevia is that it's supposed to be natural.
Right. So the Pepsi Next and, you know, the lower calorie, that's kind of seen as like, you know, I think the industry sees those drinks as, you know, tiding, you know, helping, you know, stem that decline in sales until they find this, you know, magic formula that everybody's talking about where you have like zero to no calories and yet everything's all natural.
Do you know what people are drinking instead of soda? If all these people were drinking soda and now they're not, what are they drinking?
There's been a huge boom, actually, over the past decade in bottled water. And that's complicated for Coke and Pepsi because, I mean, they both have bottled waters. But historically, bottled water just isn't as profitable as soda because most people just, you know, get whatever's cheapest at the supermarket in bulk. So what you're seeing Coke and Pepsi do now is really focus on premium bottled water because they know people want water. It's seen as healthier, but they need to find ways to charge more for it. So Pepsi, Coke actually has a premium water, and they have like Smart Water and Vitamin Water and things like that, but Pepsi doesn't. So Pepsi's actually working on something called OHM, and that's going to be a premium water that they're introducing, I think, sometime next year, likely.
Wait, Pepsi has a premium water coming out called OHM?
Right. Right now, what the bottled water that they have is Aquafina, and that's seen as, you know, it's essentially municipal water. It's tap water, and it's not seen as like a Smart Water or Evian, which have higher profit margins. So they're trying to get into the premium water space, which is a growing space, and they don't have anything right now, whereas Coke's Smart Water has done very well in the past several years. So they're working on something called OHM.
I don't know, trying to get in on the yoga boom, it sounds like.
Right, exactly.
Which is not what you associate with Pepsi.
It'll be interesting to see what the water source is, because even Smart Water, even though it's positioned as a premium water, it's also actually the source is tap water. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, with a name like OHM, with premium pricing and premium positioning, whether or not OHM is also going to be, you know, from tap water.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to watch. I mean, it makes you wonder. I mean, there's a lot of maneuvering going on, it sounds like, within the soda industry, trying to get on top again. Mm-hmm. And there's been a stigma about water. You know, there's been lots of people, well, some people, trying to legislate against sodas. And I guess, does it seem to you like the soda industry is the next cigarette industry?
I think the beverage industry understands that it's really under attack, and a lot of you know, the health advocates out there do liken soda makers to tobacco makers, what's happening in terms of, you know, the movement. But the American Beverage Association, which is the lobbying group for the industry, has been very aggressive about, you know, trying to nip all this legislation in the bud very early on. There was actually a beverage industry conference this past December where the president was talking about, you know, we have to make a greater push to kind of reach out to these local decision makers early on, and they were citing examples of legislation that they were able to stop earlier on just by kind of being out there more aggressively.
Do you think people want legislation about soda, or is this something that, you know, we can decide this for ourselves? Don't worry about it.
Well, it's interesting, you know, obviously what happened with in New York with Mayor Bloomberg's proposal. You know, the beverage industry actually had this campaign, and, you know, it said, you know, consumers can, you know, pick for ourselves, and they were very aggressive in these advertisements. And it was hard to kind of distinguish after a while, like in all these various polls, gauging what, you know, how people felt about the proposal, whether how much they had been influenced by all this, you know, lobbying and advertisement by the industry, because a lot of the responses, you know, people would give in interviews and polls would often kind of echo those sentiments, you know, we're smart enough to choose for ourselves and this and that. So it's hard to kind of tell, you know, how much of that is, you know, just people's natural reaction and how much of it is kind of, you know, mimicking what they've heard on the radio or TV or whatever it is.
So there was a headline that ran recently in the Daily Beast that posed the question, have we hit peak soda? Obviously comparing it to peak oil. I mean, do you think there's any truth to that?
Yeah, I mean, there are no signs at all that, you know, that the decline that's been going on for years is going to end or reverse. I mean, this is a very, I mean, Coke and Pepsi both have, you know, very diversified portfolios. They have all different sorts of drinks. But soda is still a huge part of their business. It's very important. And that's why this decline over the years is so concerning to them. They've made numerous efforts to try and, you know, stop it. All amazing, you know, just marketing campaigns. You see Beyonce and the Super Bowl, and nothing that they've done, despite their increased investments, has been able to stem the decline for the past, you know, several years. So I don't see what it could be that would reverse that decline.
And Beyonce got flack for selling.
Right.
We're selling soda, didn't
she? Exactly. I mean, I think that's indicative of, you know, indicative of the fate is just, you know, they signed this huge deal. They see it as a coup, and immediately they get this huge backlash, you know, that she should drop this or donate the money to, you know, health and nutrition groups. I thought that was indicative of, you know, just how people feel about soda these days.
You know, people who are my age remember growing up and going over to their friends' houses and just drinking unlimited soda all day long, including Mountain Dew and Coke and things with lots of caffeine. And now, of course, kids, you know, they have to think twice if they have an apple juice. So it's such a different culture, but a lot of us grew up with soda and didn't feel like it was bad back then. Do you think a lot of people are still, I don't know, kind of have a soft spot for soda?
I think so. I mean, you know, there's soda's still a huge business. I mean, we're watching the decline. The industry has been watching this decline, and it's an ongoing trend, but it's a very gradual trend. It's little by little, you know, it's dropping by less than 1% in many of the past several years. So I think it's still a huge business, and that's why there's so much concern about it. And I know a lot of people who still drink soda very regularly. So.
And what about you? How often do you hit the Coke bottle?
I'll drink soda like once in a while, like with certain foods, but I have also, you know, cut back enormously. I used to, as you said, I used to drink a lot of it in college and when I was younger, but I don't know. I just don't need it anymore or want it anymore.
Yeah. Do you think you'd ever go back? Is there anything the soda industry can do to lure you back into becoming a regular drinker?
You know, just personally, no. I'm pretty happy with water. I think it's, you know, I actually have a carbonation machine, so I get seltzer water, and, you know, I don't really look for anything else.
All right. Well, we'll be watching and seeing how people choose in the next coming years about soda. It's going to be an interesting thing to watch. Candace, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Candace Choi, food and beverage industry reporter for the Associated Press.
And now we want to hear from you. Are you a soda drinker? What about it keeps you coming back? And maybe you're someone who was a soda drinker but gave it up. What made you do it? And is there anything that would get you drinking soda again, diet or otherwise? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@WPR.org. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get to your calls and comments right after this break. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're taking your calls now on soda. Are you still a soda drinker? And what keeps you drinking soda? Maybe you're someone who was a heavy soda pop drinker, but you gave it up. And what made you make that change? We're curious about that. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's go to the calls. Amanda in Watertown. Hi.
Hi.
What do you think about soda?
I actually used to be a very large soda drinker. I drink probably a 2-liter Mountain Dew a day, a big Sunkist drinker, Coke drinker, basically anything that had a pretty good amount of caffeine in it. I actually remember Surge, which had a lot more caffeine than Coke in it. And I recently gave it up probably about 3 months ago, and it's gotten to the point now where if I take a sip of it, it tastes gross to me. My husband used to not be a very big soda drinker at all, and he is a very big soda drinker now, to the point where I dared him to give it up for a week, and he only lasted 2 days.
It takes some time.
Yeah, it's hard because you go to a fast food restaurant, and, you know, your soda is included in your meal, and if you want water, they give you this super small cup where, you know, you get upcharged to a bottle of water. So it's hard to give up soda when you want to give up soda because it's actually more expensive.
Right. Well, I used to drink 2 liters a day, so that's a lot that you changed. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for calling and telling us your story.
Let's go on to Doug, who joins us now from Jefferson. Hi, Doug.
Hi. And I was a pretty heavy soda drinker for a long time. And I can remember when I was a kid, you know, it was 7-ounce bottles of Coke. And then they turned into 12-ounce and then 16-ounce. And it just seemed like the soda industry wanted you to drink more and more. And to the point of, I know a lot of people that have tried to quit. They actually can't quit. It's almost like being addicted to cigarettes. My wife had that problem. She even till the day when she passed away, could not get away from Coke. I've had friends that used to drink maybe at least a dozen cans of Coke a night at work. Now they're diabetic. I've had one friend that died from being diabetic that wasn't that way originally. And I look at sugar. Sugar is extremely addictive, and I'm sure that the soda industry would like to do all it could to keep us drinking soda. So, and I don't drink it much at all anymore. I've tried really hard to get off of it, but
it's a struggle.
Hard. I think you're addicted to the caffeine. You're addicted to the sugar, and as I put it, like your guest has said, you get addicted to the fizzies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was mentioned about the carbonation machine. And sometimes it isn't even so much that I want the soda. I just want the fizzies.
Sure, there you go. Doug, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Melissa now, who joins us from Madison. Hi.
Hi. I was listening to the question and the discussion about how you get back to soda. I used to drink a lot of coffee and, like, diet cola drinks and stuff, and a lot. And I switched to tea and water. And I was thinking about the way to switch me back would be to make it more fun, like at the point of sale, like if it was just a little more interesting than slugging over to the cooler and getting that thing. And like if it was more interactive where they almost like this experience where you go up to get your Coke bottle or whatever and you press a button and all of a sudden it puts a different sleeve on it with a little panda or a little monkey or whatever. You know, like that would get me doing it again because I'd want to do the experience.
It sounds like something like bubble tea. Like making a beverage kind of fun. It has little tapioca pearls in it. It's not an active experience, but it's just a quirky way to drink a beverage. Yeah.
Yeah, almost like what attracts my children to there's little juices at the convenience store where they have like SpongeBob on top or, you know, one of these characters and then they run to it immediately. I think as adults, I mean, this adult at least is drawn to such things. So if you're going to let me put a Smurf on my Diet Pepsi, I'll probably get it.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Melissa. We'll make it shiny for you, and then you'll be might consider coming back. Jack is with us now from Eagle River. Hi, Jack.
Yeah, hi. I never have been a soda drinker. I prefer beer myself, but my wife grew up in Texas, and it's so hot, even first thing in the morning, that people would drink pop, cold pop. And I always kid her that she was drinking Texas coffee, because, obviously that kept. But she can't. She tries like heck to give it up. But you know, decaf was a big thing. But was a big change for her. But one other point at the high school here, I think in fact the middle school, they have a big display in the hall about the evils of pop, and they spell it all out, the ingredients and the junk that's in it. And so I see that, and then the next time I go to the hospital, there's a pop machine in the waiting room at the hospital. And I know that these companies probably pay people to have their machines in there. But to me, that's kind of ironic and kind of sad.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the thoughts, Jack. That's interesting. Lots of different ideas. Almost everyone remembers drinking a lot of soda, which is interesting.
And a lot of people still do.
And a lot of people still do. Yeah. That's right. Well, thank you so much for all of those calls. And don't forget, you can keep on posting, keep the conversation about soda going on the Central Time Facebook page. We're going to leave it there.
Coming up next on Central Time, we'll hear about a new set of school standards known as Common Core and receiving some pushback from a variety of groups. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If your garden is busting with tomatoes and you're not sure what to do with all of them, you'll want to stick around for advice on turning those tomatoes into fresh and healthy salsas. That's coming up on our Food Friday.
But first, it's back to school season, and while parents and students are stocking up on school supplies, educators and administrators are starting to think about how they'll adjust to a new set of school standards known as Common Core.
It's a program that sets new and rigorous goals for students at each grade level, and it's starting to attract some opposition from critics.
Here to talk about it with us is Nora Hertel. She is a reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. The center collaborates with Wisconsin Public Radio. Her new report on Common Core is going to be released on Sunday morning on wisconsinwatch.org, and it'll also be published in several newspapers around Wisconsin. Nora, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
First, let's start out by getting a basic definition of Common Core. We've been hearing a lot about it lately, and it's just sort of referenced. You know, people are for the Common Core or they're against it. So what is it?
Yeah, well, it's a set of standards that was developed in 2009 by the National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State School Officers. And the goal was to kind of establish college and career ready standards for students across all of the states.
Okay.
45 states have adopted them, Wisconsin included, and they are different from the standards we have now because right now, or I should say the previous standards that we had, cover 4th, 8th, and 12th grade. The Common Core standards cover kindergarten through 12th grade. And a lot of people would say that they go much more in depth. They require more analysis of students.
So when you say that they cover K through 12 as opposed to 4, 8, and 12, that means that the examinations are taken currently in 4th grade, 8th grade, and 12th grade? Or why did you make that distinction between K-12 and 4, 8, and 12?
Well, the standards that were written before, they only say what students need to know by fourth grade, by 8th grade, and by 12th grade. And there will actually be more testing in 2014, and those tests will align with the Common Core.
So we've been hearing a lot about Common Core, particularly in the last few months as part of the budget process here in Wisconsin. And the question I have is, you mentioned that the work on this started back in 2009. It's been floating out there for a while. Why has we been hearing so much about it lately? Where is this opposition? Where are these questions coming from?
Yeah, well, the opposition arose about 7 months ago. At least that's how the DPI, the Department of Instruction, has described it to me. They were adopted in Wisconsin in 2010, and there wasn't too much opposition at the time. But about 7 months ago, Tea Party groups in the state and actually across the country started rallying together, addressing this as a federal overreach. Another reason that this is coming up now is because those tests in Wisconsin are coming in 2014, and those changes are evident in the classroom this year. Some have been evident in the last year or so, but this is the year that most schools that are going to be testing to those standards really need to be having them in place.
To start dealing with them and to start actually seeing them turn up in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So if they were adopted in Wisconsin, how did that process work? Who adopted the standards?
Tony Evers. And since we don't have a state board of education, he has the sole authority to make that decision.
And so since they've already been adopted, what are the opponents of Common Core hoping to do? Are they hoping to slow the process down? Are they hoping to stop it? What are they looking for?
Yeah, well, when the Joint Finance Committee met, they decided they wanted to put the standards on pause. But really what that did was it just kept future standards from being adopted without a more rigorous review. There was language in the budget that also called for a review of the standards that were adopted, math and English. That review may or may not happen. The Legislative Council is still deciding if they are going to do that review, but there's a Fiscal Bureau review that's due out a week from today. So we'll have that information, and then the Department of Public Instruction is conducting a study, and then they plan to have several hearings this fall once all of that is released.
So we've talked a little bit about who is opposing the Common Core standards. Who is supporting Common Core in Wisconsin?
I talked to several administrators that are really behind it. Obviously, the Department of Public Instruction is a big fan of the standards. They've been working on implementation for the last couple years. I've noticed even the people that are a fan of the standards, administrators, department chairs, they recognize that it's a really big change, that it requires new materials, it requires professional development for teachers, and that it's going to be hard for everyone, but they think that it's worth the effort, that the standards we had before weren't sufficient, and that this is going to be good for Wisconsin.
So what happens next? You mentioned that Fiscal Bureau report is expected to come out a week or so from now. So somebody is going to get the results of this in the legislature, and then what?
Yeah, well, I asked some of the opponents what they want from this, and a few, I talked to a homeschooler in Green Bay. She used to be a teacher, and she would be happy to see us go back to the old standards, at least temporarily. The Department of Public Instruction was in the process of rewriting our own standards in 2007, and then Common Core came around, and we decided to go with what they were developing. It made it a little easier.
So now, earlier you said that the Common Core implementation has been put on pause. But as I look at my calendar right now, it's August and school is scheduled to start next couple of weeks. So where does that leave Wisconsin schools right now in terms of standards in place?
Yeah, the pause term is kind of misleading, actually, because if you look at the budget language, it basically says that we can't go forward with other standards that haven't already been adopted. So we adopted math and English, and those are going forward. What the budget specifies is that we couldn't, for instance, take science or social studies standards without a more rigorous legislative review.
So basically, we've adopted some of the standards, but not all of them, and some of them will go into effect?
Well, there are no science or social studies standards. So it's been kind of confusing as far as the way the wording in the budget. But for all intents and purposes, we're going forward with the math and the English. And if something comes out in the fiscal report or the Legislative Council uncovers something and there's a big enough backlash, then the state can choose other college and career ready standards. But they have to do that by next July. So would they have time to get it together by then? I'm not sure.
And where are key legislators on this? For example, where's Governor Walker's office on this?
Governor Walker was a supporter of the standards early on, and he did not return a request for comment this past week. He recently made a statement that was published in a different article that was pretty vague. He said high standards are important. It's important to get parent feedback, but he didn't really say these are great or these are terrible or we should move forward or we should move backward?
One of the things we've talked about, we've been focusing on Wisconsin a lot, but there are similar discussions happening around the country, right?
Yeah. There's been a lot of coverage of what's been going on in Michigan and Indiana. Indiana has really similar language, put really similar language in a law, similar to what we put in the budget. But they, their opposition seems to be more vocal. They're doing a review of the standards. They put them on pause, similar to what we did. In Michigan, they defunded the standards in their last budget. In Wisconsin, we haven't, or the Department of Public Instruction says that they haven't, we haven't put any additional state funds towards the standards. So it's been clear to me that individual districts have been spending extra money on this, rearranging funds as well.
And I hate to put you on the spot and make you make a prediction, but I'm going to ask you to make a prediction. So what do you think is going to happen with Common Core ultimately, or is it too early to tell?
My sense in Wisconsin is that, well, this is not my quote. This is one of the superintendents who spoke at the hearing on May 22nd, is that this is a moving train. You know, they've been doing this since 2010. It's in curriculum. A lot of schools have already bought new materials. It would be really expensive, I suspect, to rewind on this. And I suspect that the Legislative Fiscal Bureau will report that next Friday. They are going to be reporting how much it costs the state to do the implementation and how much it would cost to rewind on it.
And we'll see where it goes from there. Nora, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Nora Hurdle is a reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, which partners with Wisconsin Public Radio. Her new report on Common Core is going to be released on Sunday morning on wisconsinwatch.org. You can find it there. It'll also be published in several newspapers around the state.
Coming up, learn how to turn your bumper crop of tomatoes into a pantry's worth of fresh salsa. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We are in the thick of tomato season here in Wisconsin. Backyard gardens, farmers markets are overflowing with heirloom tomatoes, sun golds, purple Cherokees, every kind of tomato you can imagine.
Yeah, so how's your tomato doing?
My single tomato plant you're referring to?
That's the
one.
You
know what, Gene? It is thriving. Thank you very much. I care for it.
Well, at the Purcell house, we've got about a dozen tomato plants right now, and they're like little trees. Mm. And we have, I would say, hundreds of tomatoes. And it does beg the question, what are we going to do with all of these? The obvious answer is canning, but we've got another solution today for you from Anna Thomas Bates, and that answer is salsa. Anna is a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com, and she writes a weekly column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's food section. Anna Thomas Bates, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Anna, tell us why you think this is such a great time for homemade salsa.
Well, in my opinion, if it's not a local tomato, it's not a good tomato. And right now, the tomatoes here in Wisconsin are at their peak of juiciness and lushness. And if you're going to have a fresh salsa, now is absolutely the time to do it. Gene, I hope you'll share with Veronica.
I'll be happy to do that.
I hope you will,
that.
Too, actually.
Yeah, well, maybe if she's nice, we'll see.
I have to say, does it bug you, Anna, when you go to a restaurant right now and you get a tomato on your sandwich and it's albino? You know, it's white. It's not a real tomato in many ways.
There's really no excuse for it, is there? There's too many good tomatoes here.
Well, what are all the varieties that are out there? Can you run down some of them and tell us which ones lend themselves best to salsa?
Sure. Well, whatever tomato you like the taste of best. You know, you mentioned the purple Cherokees. I love the Brandywines. Nebraska Wedding is a really bright orange tomato. I really like the big, juicy slicing tomatoes for salsa. I know some people like to use the Italian paste aroma tomatoes because they're meatier and they think it will make a less watery salsa, but I disagree. I would much rather use a juicy tomato, chop them up, salt them, and then put them in a fine mesh sieve over a bowl, let them drain for 30 minutes, so you still get all the flavor of that great heirloom tomato, but you don't have a watery salsa.
Mm. Do you mind it when your salsa gets a little soupy?
Well, no, you just use more chips.
I like that. So tell us about Salsa 101. What is sort of your basic salsa recipe?
Sure. A basic fresh salsa recipe. You're going to have really good tomatoes, a little bit of onion, typically a white onion, some garlic maybe, cilantro maybe, and then the other two key ingredients that you cannot forget is you need an acid, a lime juice, a lemon juice, or a vinegar, and salt. And it's really that acid and that salt that's really going to make the flavors of your vegetables sing.
Are you partial to the lime or the lemon?
I usually go for the lime. It just feels a little bit more summery to me. But in my guacamole, I like to use lemon juice.
Interesting. Okay. So what about a food processor? Is it okay to just kind of mash it up, cut it up yourself, and let it do what it's going to do? Or do you like it to be kind of finely ground?
You know, it depends on what you're going for. If you want kind of a fresh, chunky, more like a pico de gallo that you're really going to scoop up with a chip, I just dice it all by hand. If you want more that restaurant style that's, you know, a lot more liquidy, that's really good for enchiladas or with eggs, then a food processor is nice. But it's definitely not a requirement to enjoy some good summer salsa.
What are some ways that we can kind of punch up our salsa, make it a little more interesting than your, you know, sort of usual pico de gallo?
Sure. There's a couple different ways. One is with some surprising ingredients. You can throw in a little bit of crisp, cool cucumber in there for some added crunch.
Hmm.
Sweet corn would be another great addition this time of year. And you can also throw in some local fruit, you know, a little bit of watermelon, some cantaloupe, you know, especially mixed with that cucumber would make an interesting salsa. And right now I'm kind of coming up with a recipe for a ripe peach green tomato jalapeno salsa.
So oh, wow. Sounds interesting.
Yeah, keep an eye on my blog for that one. I'm hoping to get it up this weekend. And the other way you can keep things interesting is with your technique. You could roast the vegetables first. You could toss them on a grill, which would just add a little bit of smokiness and some of that real good charred flavor.
So you mentioned sweet corn. For something like that, is it okay to just slice the corn off the cob into the salsa, or do you want to cook it first?
You know, it's so good this time of year. You can really easily get away without cooking it. You can just slice it off the cob and toss it in there. And with that tomato juice and that acid, it's all going to taste really good.
Now, tomatillos are another popular ingredient in salsas, and they're fun to cook with. I've cooked with them before and made salsas. We've always roasted them. How do you use tomatillos?
You know, I'm partial to roasting and grilling as well. They're a little bit of a different texture, and I just really think they get a little bit brighter and just a little bit softer and a little bit more palatable with just a little bit of cooking on them. You know, if I really want that kind of green, bright taste, I actually just throw in some green tomatoes.
Oh, green tomatoes. Do you think they're as good for you, green tomatoes, as when they'll get red and ripe and juicy?
Say that again?
Do you think they're as nutritious, green tomatoes?
Well, they're not going to have that lycopene in there, but, you know, we've got so many red tomatoes, and then we're left with all those sad green tomatoes at the very end when the frost is impending, so we might as well use them, too. They need homes as well.
So when you're making your salsas, do you can them so that and kind of preserve them, or do you just basically make them and eat them?
I do more fresh salsa. I usually save my canning. I'll just do straight up tomatoes or spaghetti sauce. You certainly can it, although I would encourage everyone to look for a tested recipe that definitely has the right amount of acid in it so that you know that it's safe to can. If you get too many onions and peppers in there, the levels of acid aren't quite right, and you could get in trouble with canning.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're cooking it as well, so it's not going to have quite the bright, fresh flavors that you will have in a salsa that you just make and enjoy.
Now, earlier this summer, we had on one of our resident WPR foodies, Lori Skelton, and she had made a strawberry salsa, which was really interesting. And I wonder if you have any more tips for including fruit. It seems kind of counterintuitive, but what does fruit do when you add it to a salsa?
Well, if you think about it, you know, the difference between a tomato and a strawberry or a tomato and a peach, they're not that far off. You know, in our heads, they're very fruits and vegetables, or at least they're categorized that way. But they're sweet. They kind of have a little bit of an exotic, almost musky flavor, which is not far off from a good peach or a cherry or a plum. So, you know, I say go ahead and experiment. You see lots of fruits and savory dishes, and this is no different. You know, a peach and an onion or a mango and an onion with some cilantro and lime juice, maybe even throw some creamy avocado in there, and you're going to have something really delicious.
So in terms of this fruit, can you make a fruit salsa that is good with a chip, or do you have to put it on something like a pork chop to really make it shine? Is it just going to be, you know, is it going to lend itself to chips?
I think so. You know, if you've got a nice limey margarita and some salty chips, you know, if you have a, you know, a pineapple, or, you know, think about honeydew and cucumber and jalapeno and onion. I think the onion and the jalapeno make it savory enough that it's still going to go really well with that chip, but with that added brightness from the fruit.
That sounds good. And so for those leftover tomatoes, now it would be lovely if we could turn it all into salsa. This sounds so delicious. But if you can't and you've got these leftover tomatoes, what do you recommend we do with them?
Oh, well, my favorite way of preserving, if you have enough room in the freezer, is to do a nice slow roast with a little bit of salt, a little bit of thyme and oregano, toss them with olive oil, quarter up the medium-sized ones, slice in half the tiny ones, and just roast them in a low oven for a couple hours till they get really nice and just start to shrivel a little bit, and you can slide all that into a big freezer bag and freeze it flat and just stack them up, and you can use them all year long in pasta sauce, bruschetta, all sorts of delicious things.
Really? So you roast them for a couple hours. What temperature?
I usually go about 200, 225.
And just on a pan, like an ungreased baking pan.
Yeah, if you want to ease the cleanup a little bit, you can line it with parchment or one of those silicone liners. They do get a little sticky, but it just concentrates the flavor, brings on a little bit of sweetness, and they're really delicious.
Oh, it sounds fantastic. Well, Anna, thank you so much for all the great ideas.
Thank you. Have a great summer.
Thanks. We've been talking to Anna Thomas Bates. She's a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. And coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll talk about the upcoming 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
We'll also be talking with a young woman who lost both her son and her husband within a 20-month period. That experience inspired her to write about her journey in Creative Grieving, A Hip Chick's Path from Loss to Hope.
That's coming up Monday on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with a guest who says people with depression need to open up and talk about what it's like to live with the condition. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.